Welcome back, everyone. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Raise Your Average. Co-hosting with me today is Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management Global. Mike, how's it going?
Comes and it goes. It's coming more than it's going these days, so that's pretty good.
Summer's winding down. Well, it's winding up for you, but it's winding down for us here in Toronto. So today, listen, we're thrilled to welcome Shanna Orchuk-Sissel, the dynamic CEO of Bonrion Capital Management, to the show. With 20 years of experience in the wealth management industry, Shanna has earned the title of Queen of Alternatives, helping independent advisors navigate the complex world of alternative investing, bridging the gap between public and private alternative investment opportunities. Additionally, she assists clients with investment platform development, alternatives in portfolio construction, and developing best practice in alternative investment due diligence. Shanna is a sought-after speaker and media contributor. She frequently shares her insights on CNBC and Bloomberg. She is not only a leader in her field, but also a passionate advocate for women in finance, mentoring the next generation, and promoting diversity within the industry. Today, we're excited to dive into her specialty, her expertise, and explore her take on the future of investing.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Shanna, welcome to the show. It's terrific to have you.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for the invite.
Shanna, before we get into our conversation, tell us about your career, your beginnings, what you learned along the way, and what's got you excited these days.
So how far you want to go back? Because we can go back.
Do you want? Yeah.
So I did not start out wanting to work in finance. My undergraduate degree is in sport management. I wanted to be a sideline reporter for ESPN. And in college, most of my internships were around that. So I worked for the New England Sport Network. I worked for a minor league hockey team in my hometown of Worcester, the Worcester Ice Cats, when the Ice Cats existed. And I've really been focused on sports as my career. But didn't work out. There was a boy. I didn't want to take a job that would take me away from said boy. So I ended up taking a job closer to where he was. And that led me to working for Morgan Stanley as a financial advisor. I thought it would just be temporary until I was able to get that coveted job at ESPN. I'm from New England, so it's not like Connecticut was that far. But ultimately, I ended up falling in love with what I was doing. I love the markets. I love the morning call. I love researching stocks and putting together portfolios. I didn't so much love the selling. And this was the days of cubicles, where you were in the bullpen, and very boiler room-ish, where we just dial all day long, open a phone book, and just dial 300 people and the manager would throw everybody's dials up at the end of the day so that you knew where you compared to everyone else, and you'd get in at 6 a.m. and you'd leave at 9 p.m. And that's just how it was. I hated that. So I decided to pursue my MBA. I went to Bentley University and got my master's in business administration with a concentration in global financial analysis, and then went to work for Fidelity. Spent several years at Fidelity, first working on the institutional sales desk and then moving into more of an analytical role, and ultimately ended up wanting to pursue portfolio management. So ended up at Russell Investments, helping support the management of the hedge fund to fund. And that is where my journey into alternatives started. It was 2007. So some people would say that's a crazy time to start working in the hedge fund world. And it was, but it was also a great learning experience. And it really helped me understand the role that alternatives can play in portfolios, both good and bad, and how they impact the market. If you recall August 07, there was a weird sell-off that was a result of all the large cap, mostly value names being sold. But it was hedge funds that kind of were the reason that was happening, because there were a lot of margin calls and they weren't able to get liquidity in the areas that were impacted by the margin. So they had to sell their most liquid stuff. So again, another example of how alternatives affect overall market conditions. And then from that point on, I've been working in the alt space. I've worked at places like Mercer Investments. I had a second stint at Fidelity Strategic Advisors, Ariel Investments, and then ultimately ended up at Orion Advisor Solutions, the fintech company. I built their direct indexing platform. I helped lead their Astro project, which is their project related to portfolio optimization technology that helped with customizing direct indexing. And then I was asked to bring the TAMP in-house, the turnkey asset management platform. So I built the foundation for what is now the Orion TAMP before moving on. And then following Orion, I jumped around helping advisors build alternative investment platforms. Ultimately, those experiences led me to launch Bonnery and Capital Management in September 2022. After working with five or six different advisors trying to help them build alts platforms, I realized what was out there as a solution for advisors was insufficient and made it really difficult for advisors to scale operationally alts of all kinds. And then the fact that the vast majority of solutions in the alt space completely ignore the fact that there are 40 Act alts like interval funds and mutual funds and ETFs, and just ignore that those are also possible ways to add alts diversification to portfolios. So I sought to create what I hope will be ultimately the best, most optimized solution, most efficient solution to remove all of the friction from the process of investing in alternatives and then scaling them for clients of all types.
Wow. Judging by your career path, I think it really demonstrates that the space is vast and maybe overly generalized, right? The term alts really encompasses, it's actually the universe, and it's a universe of its own. If you just even look at private equity and private credit, for example, as a space, most investors don't realize that it's 80% of all markets, as opposed to what we see day to day on the exchanges. So that there's a vast opportunity there that really was inaccessible up to about 5 years ago. The liquid alts space, however, has moved into the mainstream now. And that's really enabled you even further to get into the space and be able to guide advisors into areas that are now so widely accessible, as opposed to just 5 years ago.
Yeah, except that the history is actually longer than 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Before
that, it was only accessible to institutions and ultra high
net worth. No, that's actually not true. Yeah. The history of alts, 2007 is when the SEC changed the rule as it pertains to the 40 Act, allowing for greater use of leverage and shorting within funds without needing to get any sort of exemptive relief or exemptive qualification. It's not that long short funds didn't exist before then. It's just they were few and far between. They required a special exemptions by the regulators. And so they weren't commonplace. But if you recall, 2007 was when we saw the creation of the 130-30 and the 120-20 funds. Those funds were a direct result of the change in the rule. It was at that time that liquid alternatives became a thing. Every hedge fund on earth launched their long short or market neutral or event driven fund in a mutual fund wrapper. So it was actually quite common, and also closed end funds started to do the same. So you actually could get liquid alts all the way back then. The problem was it was the exact worst time to start doing anything that was hedged. So it's not that they weren't available. It's just that they all launched right around the time when no one wanted them. So the original universe of that space was substantial and has since shrunk in a meaningful way. But I think it was 2019, 2020, where we saw the SEC changes to ETFs. And ETFs were allowed to have active management. They didn't have to have full transparency on a daily basis. You didn't have to have that. With that, it allowed for these types of long-short strategies, these types of alternative strategies, to start to come to market as ETFs. Around the same time, maybe a little before, the interval fund became a thing. So it goes back at least a decade that these things have been available. So the reason you think it's only been in the last 5 years is because no one cared until the pandemic about these types of alternative strategies. Yeah, all of these things have been available, but nobody wanted them because the market was going straight up. And so there wasn't a lot of product being launched because there was no demand. But then when the demand went up, everybody and anybody started looking for ways in which to launch the product. There's now over 200 interval funds on the market, mostly real estate related. There is some other stuff, but it's really heavy. I would say 75% of the interval fund market is real estate. And then in the mutual fund market, what was at one point 1,000 plus funds is now more like 300. And ETFs, maybe 400 or 500 alternative ETFs that are out there. So this has been around for a while. A lot of them have really long trackers. You look at AQR. AQR has had alternative mutual funds forever.
Right.
And this is not new. Just nobody cared before.
So, Shanna, the landscape of alternatives that you're outlining is awesome and how it's changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
What are the trends you're seeing today that maybe excite you and are opportunities for investors, and maybe some trends where you're a little bit head tilted? And then that maybe I'll attach a question to that in the sense of how are they being used? How are you, what are the challenges of the use of alternatives? Are they being used correctly? Are we getting those non-correlated type of alternatives and a pickup there? Or is it largely the correlated alternatives that are extensions of certain betas? I know there's a lot there. So maybe
there is a lot there. So we'll start with trends, right? So I will have the most timely trend, the news that just hit today, that's on every financial media program yesterday and today, and every media publication has it on the front page. NFL approves private equity to invest in NFL teams. Okay. That is sports. Sports rights is not new, but it is absolutely the space that there's the most interest right now. And this vote by the owners and by the NFL was a big deal. I have been interviewed by Sportico, P&I, and everybody because they want to know my thoughts on it, not just because I know the space of alternatives, but as we alluded to early on, my background is actually sports.
Right.
So it is the perfect confluence of my two areas of expertise. And so I am loving this trend. I think it's super interesting, but people need to understand that investing in athletic teams and sports is a completely different world than traditional investments. And what I mean by that is in sports, your goal is not to make money. It's to spend as much money as possible to win championships, because the only way your value goes up is if your team has won championships. That is what gives you all the other things that come with that, like the licensing, the value of your team, the ability to sell all the other ancillary stuff that doesn't get put in the pot for the league. So it's a different animal. The other thing is, I noted this in the interview I did with Pension and Investments, is that in sports, if you want to buy a team, you can't use debt. You can't use debt. It's not allowed. So this actually opens up opportunities and will only further pressure valuations of sports teams to go up, because now you have another equity buyer coming into the market that has a lot of capital. That's worth noting. Sports rights, super exciting to me. Advisors are super excited about it. There's not a lot of opportunities out there. The most interesting opportunity I've seen in the space is the one that's just being launched by Avenue Capital. In my opinion, it's the most diversified, gives you the most different ways to invest in sports. It's not just professional sports. There's funds that just do baseball and just do professional sports. But the Avenue Fund does lending to professional sports teams because banks won't lend because you're not looking to make money and banks want to see profits. And then they also do some of the more up and coming, like they're really big into women's sports, things of that nature. All right. So that is one thing, because this is like a 7-part question.
Yeah. it was too many parts.
Yeah. So second thing, interesting things that I'm excited about, but also nervous about, the kind of increasing attention and increasing growth going on in the interval fund world. I am on the record as saying I have a love-hate relationship with interval funds. I love them because they are finally a way for everyday investor to gain access to areas of the market that had traditionally been closed off for them, largely because it required an accredited investor hurdle and there's a lot of illiquidity. Now, interval funds don't address the illiquidity, and a heavy emphasis on that, because I don't think that people really appreciate the illiquidity of interval funds. The illiquid conversation has to happen no matter who your client is. Just because they qualify for something doesn't mean that they will be okay with things like, I can't get my money out, like, for a really long time. And an interval fund is a great solution for clients that aren't qualified, but it's massively less liquid than a traditional LP structure. And I'll explain. So an interval fund has a mandate that they can make 25% of the fund NAV available for liquidity, usually on a quarterly basis. But that's 25% of the fund, not your investment. And so that also means that those funds tend to only allow for redemptions of less than 25%, usually anywhere between 5 and 10% every quarter. So if you put in $100,000 and you suddenly need your money out, you're talking 10 quarters before you could hypothetically get all your money out at best. Whereas with a capital call structure, there's usually a healthy secondary market. And that healthy secondary market makes liquidity a little better. You might not get your full value, but you'll get liquidity. In most cases, I prefer, if all things being equal, if a client is able to invest in the private fund as an LP, that's a better option. But I love that interval funds are allowing for the average investor to gain access to illiquid areas. And I want to preface that by saying there's a reason these things are in interval funds. They aren't inherently liquid. So it's not like they're trying to get one up on you. It's that they can't provide you daily liquidity because, for example, let's talk about real estate. I mentioned that most interval funds are real estate based. If I own a physical piece of property, right? How do I know the value of that property, right? I have to get an appraiser out. You think an appraiser is going to come to your house every single freaking day to give you a price? No. They come maybe once a quarter, once a year, and that is the price. So that is how they get the price of it. So they can't give you daily pricing and daily liquidity. It's impossible. So real estate's a great example, but that would be true with a number of things. Things have to be appraised because they don't have a active, liquid public market that is going and making trades every second. And these interval funds are illiquid for a reason, but what you can possibly invest in these products, and the big trend I'm seeing here is venture capital is launching these things. It's their job right now. You're seeing them everywhere. And then you're seeing funds like firms like Apollo convert traditionally private product into interval and tender offer funds. Tender offer funds are a slightly different animal. They are like interval funds, but tend to have a hurdle. It gets around some of the rules of 3C7 and 3C1, which limits the number of investors that can be in a product, but it still has a hurdle, but it is registered. And so that's just food for thought. There is a slight differentiation between the two. And it is very interesting. I think having access to these less efficient, less liquid markets has the potential for alpha. But also, if you think about the passive investing effect on markets, the more money runs into something, the more efficient it becomes. So we're very early innings here, but depending on how it goes, you could lose some of the alpha that had traditionally been available in these spaces because too much money is running after too little opportunity. So that interval funds and
a couple of things there. Should we,
okay.
Do you want to dive into some questions on that, or do you want to list the things that you're seeing first and then we can dive into some questions?
It's your call. Let's go with you asking questions.
Okay. So you've got the interval funds, you've got liquidity challenges there, maybe some liquidity or some volatility laundering as well. So the
Clip Asness loves that term.
Yeah. let's give Clip props on that.
That is his term. I need to make sure he's a friend. Personally love him. He's been a huge supporter of mine for a really long time. And I think he coined the term volatility laundering.
Yeah. Which is, for those who are listening, is just because you have these NAVs that are not produced on a daily basis and may not reflect the actual prices that things would sell out on a day-to-day basis, the volatility of the portfolio is lower. And then when you adjust that portfolio returns by that risk, it can at times overstate the risk-adjusted returns. Now, sometimes that's a benefit because you can't have your funds when you would want to make a mistake. At the same time, an interval funds, I always, and even the sports teams and the potential for that you mentioned earlier, what is the reality of actual quality deals trickling down to advisors for them to put in portfolios? Oftentimes, these great projects are dominated by the large players, and the deals
that
might trickle down. Yeah. Why don't you elaborate on that with respect to those few challenges within this particular space?
This is something I've been very vocal about. And I try to, a lot of advisors, I don't think realize this. I always say, if it came into your inbox unsolicited as an advisor, it probably is not good.
Short it.
If it got down to you, it's because nobody else wanted it that had assets. And I generally think these big firms out there in the PE space, in the private credit space, the really well-known ones, typically only make available to advisors the stuff they couldn't sell to the institutions. We can debate this all you want, but that has been my personal experience, because if it's an awesome investment, the institutions are oversubscribing it, and that's that. That said, I think that there are a lot of folks, especially the smaller boutique firms, which is what Bonran really focuses on, that understand and actually appreciate the advisor market and want to build relationships with advisory firms and be a partner and not just looking as an asset grab and a way to unload bad deals. And that is a huge opportunity. The problem is, anybody who's ever worked in the alternative space knows that, like, finding stuff, it's a massive universe. First off, you alluded to that earlier.
Yeah.
Also, a massive universe for all the mutual fund companies and issuers and ETF issuers out there. There's 10 times more in the alternative space. The problem is, because they're private funds, right? The offerings in many occasions, the regulatory rules say they can't market themselves. They can't. How do you find them? You've got to go to where they are. And most advisors are not going to spend any of their hard-earned money and profits to go to cap intro events. They're just not. It's basically sitting at a table and taking 25 meetings and meeting with a manager and speed dating. It's not a good use of their time. Advisors' best use of time is building and growing relationships with the clients they have and bringing in new clients, not sitting for 3 days and doing 25-minute speed dating interviews with managers. That is where you find them, though. And so
that's what you're doing.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's inherently what we do. Our goal is to build out the most robust platform of different options, focusing on ways to have some of these smaller boutique firms available to advisors and have some level of exclusivity. Like, we have firms on our platform right now that aren't looking to raise billions of dollars. They're looking to raise $50 million, $100 million. And I always say to them when I talk to them, you don't need 100 advisors, you need 10 of the right advisors. And I say the same to advisors. You don't need 100 managers, you need 10 of the right managers. And if we can cull the herd, if you will, for you to find the right managers that are looking for advisors to work with and don't want to work with big institutions because they're not raising hundreds of millions of billions of dollars. That is a better fit than some of these very large institutions. Plus, as was pointed out to me yesterday when I was speaking to someone on this topic, anybody can go get KKR and Blackstone. You can get it on Case. You can get it on ICAP. You can go to Goldman. You can go to JP Morgan. So if you're a smaller independent advisor, how do you differentiate yourself? It's not going to be with that. And at the end of the day, finding these ideas matters. But also, to your point with interval funds, most of the TAMPs don't support interval funds at this time. And so a lot of the custodians also don't make them the easiest thing in the world to trade. You have to fill out a ton of paperwork ahead of time before you can trade it. So just because it has a ticker doesn't mean it's super easy to invest in. And so we seek to resolve some of those issues, do that education, and find those ideas. But to your point, most of the time, these big firms are unloading bad or less attractive deals to advisors. But I will say that I think that will change over time as most of them have tapped out most of the institutional money and realized that the low-hanging fruit at this point is the trillions of dollars managed by financial advisors that have never been tapped into. The problem is, and I have to coach our asset manager clients on this all the time, it's not a quick sale. It is a long runway yeah. before you get any assets. Advisors are understandably leery about these products, and they are going to kick the tires for a while, and you're going to have to prove yourself to them. More importantly, there's a ton of upfront education that has to happen. And those two things we try to help speed up and coach our managers on so that when they are working with advisors, they're fully prepared to be able to address their questions, educate them, and they're prepared for that process and understanding. But as more of these firms look to advisors, a lot of them are like, they go in and out quickly because they're like, oh, I want advisor money. And then it takes too long and they get really frustrated and they're not willing to spend the money to make the investment in distribution strategy for the space. And those guys will never get it. But the ones that do, I think ultimately win. And I think 10 years from now, the firms we'll be talking about in the alternative space as loved by advisors are firms you've never heard of before.
I think there's a fundamental difference between the asset owner too, between advisors and what are institutional.
Yeah, there's an emotional attachment to those investments.
There's an emotional side, but there's also the actual structure of a pension plan or an endowment where money mm-hmm. is actually locked away for a long period of time versus right. an individual investor that has a finite timeline. They just don't know what that timeline is, i.e. when they would die or when they would need the assets, which is very different structurally. So
yep, there's that.
It does require a lot of education, but yeah, please.
There's that structure, but there's also the emotional attachment.
Absolutely.
I've been an institutional allocator and I've been an allocator for retail investors. And I can tell you that retail investors are far less rational about making decisions on buying and selling in a portfolio than institutional investors. When I was an institutional investor, I would say that 90% of the time, if we fired a fund, it had nothing to do with performance. Nothing to do with performance. It was an operational issue. A PM left. Sometimes they could perform better than expected, but that was exactly why they were fired, because they moved away from the mandate we hired them for, mm-hmm. right? In the retail space, 90% of the time you get fired for performance because of the emotional attachment there. So right. it's a wildly different approach because you're not emotionally attached to that asset, the underlying asset to that money. And that makes a big difference. But yes, to your point, a pension fund, an endowment, maybe only needs 1% cash flow to support, or 3% cash flow to support its liabilities. That's that whole liability-driven investing, where you look at how much cash flow you need to produce to meet the liabilities of the fund, and then you match it with income from fixed income product, and then you use what's left to invest in riskier assets to try to grow the pot. That's how LDI works. When I worked at Mercer, that's what we did. it was just LDI investing for pension funds. On the endowment side, usually it's just very low cash flow needs. So they can, endowments more than any are the ones that go into these big lockups because they don't need liquidity at all. They can get a treasury at 3% and that'll support the needs of cash flow of the funds because they have a lot more money coming in than going out. And that's a different model as well. Depending on the type of institution, you'll see vastly different things. You don't see 80% in private and pensions, but you certainly do in endowments.
Right. And on the retail side, not only is the on-ramp to these solutions really long, as you mentioned, but investors often make the mistake of looking at the performance. Sometimes these strategies, looking at it in isolation and think, why would I want to own this thing? They don't like the performance because it doesn't match up with what their expectations look like. And they don't like the line item. And then for the advisors, it's also the line item risk.
Yeah. Right? So there's two things in the point you just made. First off, Michael Kitches, a year ago, put up something on LinkedIn and it made me laugh because it's so true. It's like diversification is always having to say you're sorry.
Yeah.
And I think that's
Portnoy,
true.
We got to give props to Brian Portnoy for that.
Is that Portnoy's quote? Because it was Kitches that posted it that I saw it. Yeah, but if it's Portnoy, Brian doesn't live that far from me.
Yeah.
And I see him all the time. And if that's his quote, props to Brian. That's a great quote. And I want to make sure he gets credit for it. I thought it was Mike. But that said, yeah, you're absolutely right. I did a podcast interview last week with Investopedia, Caleb Silver, and he and I talked about this when we were talking about managed futures, right? So managed futures is what I call a diversifying alternative. To this point, most of what we talked about are not diversifying alternatives. They're just private, less liquid beta of equity and fixed income,
right?
That's what private credit is. That's what private equity is. It's equity. It's credit. It's very correlated to public equity and public credit. As was pointed out, volatility laundering makes it look less correlated, but it doesn't change the fact that it moves directionally in the same way. And actual technical term for that, volatility laundering is sexier. That's actually called the smoothing effect. That is the technical term, which doesn't sound so evil. But because it doesn't have a NAV, doesn't strike a NAV in the smoothing effect, it can make it look less correlated, but the fact of the matter is it's highly correlated. That said, the stuff that's not correlated is the stuff that you're talking about. It's the line item that the advisors are going to get questioned on every single quarter when they sit down with their clients,
right,
unless there's stress in the market. So the two products, maybe three, that kind of fall into this bucket of being massively effective diversification with low to no correlation to traditional fixed income or traditional equity are managed futures and market neutral, because market neutral removes all market risk and managed futures are just completely uncorrelated. And then global macro is in that as well. It's managed futures, right, and global macro tend to perform very similarly, even though they're not technically exactly the same, they're doing the same thing. Those three products are massively effective diversification tools. And when added to a portfolio, regardless of how they're doing, adds to risk-adjusted returns. There's an ETF that I am a huge fan of. I think everybody knows this about me. That is issued by AGF, which, disclaimer, is a partner of Bonrians. But I've been talking about BTAL long before that. And actually,
right,
part of the reason why they're a partner is because I went to their chairman and was like, look, I've been talking about your fund for a long time. I'm responsible for a lot of flows. Can you help me out here? We'd love to have you on board. And they were like, absolutely. But that notwithstanding, they have an ETF called BTAL. It's equity market neutral, goes long, low beta stocks of the S&P and short, high beta stocks of the S&P and equal measures. So it's completely neutral. And I call it low vol on steroids.
That's the fund managed by Bill DeRoche, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And it's an anti-beta fund?
Yeah, it's called the AGF US Market Neutral Anti-Beta Fund. Yep.
Yeah.
BTAL. And the reason I pointed out is maybe a year or so ago, I got into a little debate on Twitter with somebody about the fund. on why I would use BTAL instead of cash. And the response was, why would I use a product that could go negative? Because BTAL does at times go negative and meaningfully. But when you actually throw it in a portfolio, because you can get outsized upside too, it actually, on a risk-adjusted basis, gives you better overall performance and lower overall risk by adding a portion of BTAL versus that same allocation to cash. So it's, this is the way you got to think about it. The problem is these are highly complex instruments. BTAL is one of the easier ones to explain. I think yeah. I just explained it in a, and you got it. But there are managed futures and other products that are using options and derivatives that are way more complicated. And if I'm an advisor and I have this in a client portfolio and it's a constant source of, why do I own this? Why is it down? And I don't really understand it and I can't really articulate the why well, then I'm not sticking in that product. It's just more hassle than it's worth.
Intuition, yep. You don't have the intuition, and it's really hard in managed futures portfolios, given they can be trading, you know, 30 to 130 markets and be long and short those markets. On a day when stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies are up or down, you're not going to have a lot of intuition of what's going on in your managed right. futures portfolio. And that's part of, I think, the big educational process that has to occur with respect to those products and actually being liquid alternatives. So they provide some buffer and bounce to that, those largely beta driven, low cost portfolios of today.
Yeah. And
Shanna, okay. Mike, you spend a lot of intellectual energy. You devote a lot of intellectual bandwidth to this subject.
Yeah.
At your end by Resolve. And, I just wanted to point that out because I think like you, what you're doing at Resolve is going a very long way to explaining how managed futures work in a portfolio setting, not in isolation.
Right.
And the benefits of that.
But I think that's the premise of the return stack portfolio solutions and the return stack ETFs. It's a function of you want beta and what you want to do is just stack on top of that whatever managed futures strategy that you'd like, whether that's carry or trend, multi-strat, because of capital efficiency. This is portable alpha, if we go back 10 or 15 years, but it's bringing it to the marketplace and bringing it to the advisor so that it's cloaked a little bit. It's a little bit of honey that helps the medicine go down so that you know, when the S&P is ripping, the albatross born by diversification isn't too burdensome to cause the investor to quit, right? Often it's said diversification is the only free lunch, and I would strongly disagree with that statement. Diversification is not a free lunch. It is very difficult to adhere to and stick to, especially when you get common asset classes like the S&P 500 dominating for 12, right. 15 years. Anyway, back over to you, Jen.
Back in January, we had Corey Hoffman from Newfound on our podcast, and the episode is titled Return Stacking because the nature of that entire interview was about exactly what you're talking about.
Partner, it's Newfound and Resolve.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, Corey Hoffman.
Yeah.
Did I say Corey Hoffman? Oh my God. Apologies. Corey, I love you and I'm sorry. I'm on a deal with you in 2 weeks, in a month, and I am so sorry. You know, I love you.
Sending him, I just sent him a Slack. I'm teasing.
But my point being is, yeah, so we did an entire episode of the Alternative Mason podcast on that subject. But to your point, one of the things I'd like to say is alt should be approached like we approach equity and fixed income. What I mean by that is we teach advisors how to build equity portfolios. They inherently know you got your little Ibbotson chart, right? And we teach them, you never know which is going to perform best at any given time. So you want to have a little bit of everything, right? So you have large cap, small cap, mid cap, value, growth, core, whatever. Sectors. We know this. Fixed income is the same. Investment grade, non-investment grade, floating rate. You do that. But we don't teach them that in alts. Now, JP Morgan's guide to alternatives that they put out every quarter actually does have an Ibbotson-like chart inside it of just alts, which I love because it is starting that discussion. But we're sitting here talking about managed futures. A lot of advisors know that managed futures are inherently diversifying, so they'll just do managed futures as the diversifying alternative in the portfolio. But to your point, managed futures really are going to be an albatross to you until the market is not raging. And then you're really happy you own it. Like insurance, right? No one likes writing the check for your insurance every month. But if something happens and you need to file a claim, you're really glad you did. You're really glad you have it. Managed futures, the same thing. However, I think if you think about alternatives as the same way of building portfolios as equity and fixed income, and you're looking at 4 or 5 different types of products that are all uncorrelated to each other and the market, you end up actually with a little portfolio that actually doesn't look so bad and isn't as much of a drag. At Bonrion, we have an open architecture model marketplace, a 40 Act product, where we manage 3 Bonrion models. So there's the Bonrion Alternative Alpha model, which is full of things that have a little more volatility and risk. So you're going to see long short in those portfolios. You're going to see real estate related. You're going to see Bitcoin. You're going to see Ether in those portfolios. We have our core Bonrion alternative model, which I've been managing since my time at Orion, which is like my philosophy of how I think alt should be built. You're going to have market neutral. You're going to have some fixed income arbitrage, things of that nature in there, a nice little combination. And then we have the Bonrion alternative income, which is alternative sources of income. And that's the focus of that product. So we have the 3 models, and then we have managers on the platform like Simplify Asset Management, Today's Asset Management, Cloud Capital that have models too. And they have their own models that are building them in their flavor, but they're usually 4 to 5 funds of different flavors that complement each other really well and diversify each other and then diversify your portfolio. So whenever you build a fund of funds, and I've been doing it for a long time since my time at Russell, you look to add things to the portfolio that in a vacuum may not look so attractive because you're looking at the correlations of the excess returns, not the returns, the excess returns. So for example, if I build a fund to fund of value funds, there are probably going to be 1 or 2 value funds in there that in a vacuum, if you just chose one, probably wouldn't be it. But in the context of 5, they're probably the most diversifying of the 5. And so it's the same thing when you build alt portfolios. And that's something I really like to stress, because it also makes the conversation easier. That managed futures fund that is underperforming is not 20% of your portfolio. It's 5 or it's 4.
Right.
And so it's not as much of a pain in the butt every quarter to have to talk about.
Can you walk through, I think advisors might find value in just broad strokes, talking through the different alts and those that are more non-correlated or negatively correlated, and categorizing those versus those that are maybe more correlated, but are trying to capture a slightly different risk premia, but will probably have a function of the liquidity or growth shocks in them that makes them act a little bit more like beta. Maybe could you give just a high end view of that? Because I think that would help the advisors that are listening in. And then maybe you could just give how you walk through that thinking in building a portfolio high level, just not getting too specific, but maybe a framework that might help trigger some ideas for advisors and in thinking through this problem.
Sure. So I'll start by answering the first question of like how, what's diversifying, what's non-diversifying alts, by thinking about it in the realm of how alts seen and bucketed, right? So private equity, private credit are what I call non-diversifying alts. They are driven by the beta of credit markets and equity markets. What is the most diversifying tend to be the things that were always in hedge funds, right? Most hedge funds, most, not all, with exceptions, like there are microcap long-only hedge funds because microcaps are inherently illiquid and hedge fund structures are the most optimal way to manage that. But the vast majority of categories that hedge funds fall into, relative value, event driven, equity long short, short biased, market neutral, global macro, managed futures, I can go on and on, right? those are diversifiers because they are in some way either hedging beta, so you're getting less beta. That's the whole point. That's why they're called hedge funds, like inherently. We use hedge funds broadly now to talk about essentially anything that's an evergreen alternative product. Hedge funds in their most pure sense are meant to hedge. So if you're hedging, then you're inherently reducing beta. That's just the nature of the point. That's the whole point, right? Is to reduce the market risk, and market risk is the definition of beta. Traditionally, things that were found in hedge funds are the most diversifying. The good news is those are also the most common liquid alts, right? Private equity and private credit, if they're going to come in a liquid alt, they're going to be in an interval fund and they're still going to be a liquid. But in the ETF and mutual fund space, the vast majority of what's there are the diversifier stuff. It is the long short equity. It is the, maybe not short bias because of the limitations of the 40 Act, but there is long short equity. There is market neutral. There is global macro. There is multi-strat. There is fixed income arb. That exists in liquid alt form. So actually, it's the most accessible of everything. It's also the most liquid because even if you went with a hedge funds tend to be fairly liquid. And I always tell advisors when evaluating a product, I want to see the liquidity match the underlying. The managers will tell you their liquidity matches their fund structure and like how they manage money. I think that that's very nice, but I only care about whether or not your liquidity structure matches what you're investing in, because it's not my responsibility to ensure that your business, you know, keeps running. My responsibility is to make sure that if my client needs its money, they can get it. So I focus on that. Like, I never like seeing a long short equity fund that's investing in larger cap stocks to tell me you have quarterly redemptions. Like, that's the dumbest thing ever. No, it should be monthly. And I think monthly is completely fair from a business management perspective and a liquidity perspective. But because they're dealing and just doing these more exotic hedging strategies, but using traditional public market underlying investments, they tend to be extremely liquid and extremely available. As advisors look to build portfolios and you look at the space of alts, you have to think of it in a couple of different ways. If you're looking at private equity and private credit, understand why you're doing that. The reason you're looking at those spaces is not because of the diversifying benefits to the portfolio. You're looking at it because of the potential for alpha to the portfolio. And so the conversation has to start with a discussion of liquidity budget. And can your client put 10% aside? 10% for me is a good number to start with for clients that, you know, 10% of your portfolio completely illiquid, I think is a reasonable amount to suggest. And I always say that sometimes the easiest way to start that conversation is to introduce them to an illiquid opportunity that they're going to get excited about. So sports rights, going back to where we started, is a perfect example of that. Clients get so excited when you bring sports rights to them, they no longer care that it's not liquid because they can go brag to their buddies that they are an owner of their favorite sports team, albeit a 0.05%. But it doesn't matter if you own 0.05 or you own 5%. Both of you are minority owners and your share doesn't matter. And you can still brag to your friends. So they don't care about illiquidity. And so that's a great way to start to gain comfort with the idea of illiquidity, is introducing it through something that they're going to get excited about. On the other hand, you should always be thinking about diversifying alts as a 20% slug in your portfolio. We can debate if it should be something like 50, 30, 20, as opposed to 60, 40. I'm a little more nuanced. I take it from both fixed income and equity in equal amounts. So it ends up being like $800,000. I have $1 million, $800,000 goes into 60, 40, $200,000 goes into alternatives. And that fractionally is not round numbers. So that's my preference. But to simplify it, a 50, 30, 20 approach is easy, nice round numbers. And that should be what you use instead of the 60, 40, in my opinion. All kinds of research going back decades JP Morgan has some great stuff in their Guide to the Markets Alternatives, Guide to Alternatives piece that they do quarterly, where they actually show this, that if you put 30% in hedge funds, they use hedge funds because that's what has the most history, they will be able to offer a better risk-adjusted return. I can show the same thing with a 20% slug in liquid alts because that's got some history going back maybe 10 years. And I can demonstrate the same thing. It's not going to knock your socks off. You are not going to be like, oh my God, I improved. It's like 20 basis points improvement in performance, but it's substantial improvement in risk and reducing the standard deviation of the portfolio. So if you're going into this thinking it's going to be really sexy and you're going to have this great outperformance of the, you will barely notice it in your returns, but you will absolutely notice it in the overall volatility of the portfolio.
It's funny. When I was an advisor over 15 years ago now, 20 years ago now, it was what was exciting in the business in the 90s was money managers, the Peter Lynch's and the Will Danoffs and the names, right? The big names. Those were the things that made
Will still working. Will is still crushing it.
Yeah. But it's names like that. John Templeton, Michael Price, those big names in equity management were some of the reasons the business was really exciting. Mm-hmm. The market wizards, right? And when you look at the way that the business has evolved over the last 15, 20 years into indexing and passive, just buying beta, buying in S&P 500 indexes, NASDAQ, it has become exciting in a boring way, but less exciting. And I like the reason I'm bringing this up is because I like the idea that you're fostering, which is that when you introduce alternatives to your clients, you should find something that matches up with their interests. So somebody is a sports fan. If someone talks endlessly about sports, that's a great entry point for the discussion. Mm-hmm. If somebody's an art collector, if somebody really loves going to the art gallery, to the museum or the gallery, use fine art investments or crowdfunding opportunities, investing opportunities in art, like Masterworks or something, to get them talking about that alternative.
Wine. There's a firm called InvestBev that does investing in whiskey and tequila. There's a firm called Oneo, I think it is, that does wine, right? And every year they send you a case of the best vintage. And then at the holidays, you can open the case and say, this is from my vineyard. Again, bragging rights. I call it passion and value investing, right?
Yeah.
And by value, I don't mean the value in the traditional sense, but like values aligning with what is important to you. That is you're preaching to the choir on that one. That is a massive part of what I talk about when I talk to advisors about using alts. There is no better place for an advisor to go to find ways to connect with their clients and get their clients excited about investing, especially, and to differentiate themselves from their peers than alts. Because everybody and their mother can offer a Vanguard model.
Yeah. The mathematicians in the business, like Cliff Asness, are going to get really excited about the math and passionate about talking about the math. But most people aren't mathematicians, right? They understand what they understand and what they know and feel comfortable with or get excited about. And so the math is important. Explaining what you just did a moment ago about 20 basis points of increase and a more substantial reduction in standard deviation. But if you don't add to that dimension of your explanation, this values link where someone can get excited about the topic from a top-down level, you're going to have a much harder time if you're just approaching it from a mathematical standpoint.
I view it as a business development tool, to be quite honest. I'd like to encourage advisors to use this as a business development tool, bringing these ideas to your clients. So one of the things we do at Bonnerian is we partnered with Proudmouth, which is Matt Halloran. Matt is excellent at working with advisors to help them understand their brand and understand their clients and their niche. So a great example is we like to have our advisors sit down with Matt if they like, to better understand what is their client niche, right? Sometimes advisors have no idea that they have a niche, or they want a niche, but they just don't know what it is. So I remember Matt telling me a story. He worked with an advisor and he said to the advisor, what's your ideal client? And they were like, I want to work with executives from Verizon. And he was like, okay, how many executives at Verizon are there? A couple thousand. How many clients would you like to have? 150. You can, yeah, it's not the widest net in the world, but having a narrow net of very specific opportunities and then creating the knowledge base where you are the most knowledgeable. You understand the Verizon comp structure better than anyone that doesn't work at the company makes you the most appealing advisor to the 3,000 executives at Verizon, and you only want 150 of them. So that's a funnel. And so spending time understanding how to build that funnel and what you're looking for, and then what kind of product will appeal to that. And that's what I'm talking about, is figuring out what firms, what funds, what types of strategies are going to appeal to the niche of clients either you already have or you want to appeal to. And spending that time, you can't do that with Vanguard. You can't do that with Fidelity. Everybody has access. They have access to that in their 401k. That's not differentiated. That is not how you grow your relationship and deepen your understanding. 80% of clients don't feel like their advisor knows them very well. And any opportunity they have to leave that advisor, they will leave. So advisors, newsflash, your clients want you to know them on more than a superficial level. Right. So how do you have those conversations? Alt can be that opening, right? What are you passionate about? Because there's all kinds of investments out there. And I'd love to get you something that really aligns with the things that get you excited, that you're super passionate about, that are important to you. And so if I get to know you better and I ask those questions and I realize you love wine, or you're a huge sports fan, or you love horses, or helping women in business is important to you. There's microfinance funds that help female entrepreneurs in third world countries. There's so many ways to play this. There's real estate funds that do workforce housing development, which can be important to people in certain communities if they come from a long line of like law enforcement, right? That might be important to have affordable workforce housing. Workforce would be things like your first responders.
That's a whole new definition of impact of impact investing, impact like investing, right? It's not what I find what's really appealing about what you're talking about is that the on-ramp is so long. Like, it's one thing to get advisors on board with an alternative strategy, any alternative strategy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of time spent explaining. It's a whole other thing when they have to transfer some of that knowledge to their client. And then they can't, because the client can't possibly get on the level quickly enough. And the turnaround time might be too long that the advisor just abandons it and just sticks to what they've been doing all along.
Yeah,
without evolving. I want to assume that advisors want to evolve in the marketplace with the conditions that exist, the regime change, higher for longer, whatever comes our way, and be prepared for whatever comes our way by diversifying, or by getting their clients more diversified into diversifying alternatives as well as low correlation alternatives. But getting them there is only getting the advisor on board educationally is only half the battle. It's how do you help them transfer that knowledge to the client? And by creating a level of engagement where the client feels heard or understood or known to the advisor, my advisor knows me, my advisor, oh yeah, we clicked. Suddenly they're listening. The client's ability to listen to what the advisor is saying to them or explaining to them about something, like maybe going back again to the sports.
Yeah, the sports, you know, is the easiest one. And honestly, I came to this realization of this approach because of a sports rights fund. When I first started Bonrin, like really early on.
That's what it did for you.
It wasn't just that. It was that we were approached by a firm who had a sports rights fund, and they weren't partnering with us or anything, but we were trying to get in front of advisors. So we sent out an email about a sports rights fund, and the most opened email I've ever had, most response ever from the advisors immediately. And I thought to myself, and all of them were the same thing. Oh my God, this is so cool. And then I thought to myself, oh wow. Sometimes you don't even really have to get into the weeds if it's cool enough. So what else is cool? So then I went out and started thinking and looking, and I thought, wine. So every time I actually talk to an asset manager, my brain starts thinking about, okay, how can I create the story to create the excitement, even on the most boring types of products? And while I'm fairly analytical and I love to build portfolios, I inherently have that kind of marketing brain. And so I'm always thinking in that respect.
Shanna, you're probably always looking at the addressable market for the space that you're in, for the alternative space. What does it look like right now? Like, how big is this opportunity for advisors to exploit as in terms of where they are today, where the business thinks there's an opportunity for advisors to differentiate themselves for more than for obviously for functional reasons, for reasons that benefit their clients, but also for business development.
Sure.
In terms of setting themselves apart from the pack, from the industry at large.
So talk some numbers, and I think that'll be helpful. There's approximately $3 trillion managed by advisors, whether they be registered representatives for broker dealers under FINRA or registered investment advisors. There's $3 trillion in that space, like not in non-institutional money. There's roughly 50,000 advisors firms, like advisors in the country. So $3 trillion managed by about 50,000 advisors. So it's a huge space. And to be clear, some of that is also like family offices and things of that nature. They fall into this bucket too. If you look at it from that perspective, this is a massive potential investor pool. To date, academic research has been saying forever, whether it be Preqin or Case and Mercer do a study annually talking about advisors allocating to alts. To date, the prediction has been that advisors would move and shift their investments in alternatives to align with how institutions have consistently allocated, which institutions invest anywhere between, on average, 20 and 30% of their portfolios into alts. So there's been this prediction that advisors will get there. As I sit here right now, the number is like 7. Actually, that might be even generous. Advisors are generally allocating somewhere between 5 and 7% of client portfolios to alts, and 70% of that 50,000 pool don't allocate to alts at all. And the opportunity is massive, massive, because 70% of your peers aren't talking to their clients about these things. That's in of itself a huge differentiator. And so that's the opportunity set, really. That's why you're starting to see asset managers pay attention, because it's a big pool. And advisors want to talk about it. It's the topic du jour. The problem is everybody thinks the reason we're at 5 to 7% is lack of education, not understanding allocations, things of that nature. And there is absolutely some of that to it. But the vast majority of the reason advisors don't allocate to alts is because really freaking hard operationally. There's 100-page sub-documents that require all kinds of signatures.
Right.
You have to do extensive levels of due diligence because the SEC is going to require it. And if it blows up, you are going to get fined and you need to, cover your ass. You need due diligence. The vast majority of advisors don't have 10-person investment teams to do that. Even the biggest advisory firms out there, whether it be Dynasty, whether it be Crescent or Hightower or Mariner, have five people. Five people. And advisors are told that if you want to be considered if you want an alt considered, you have to send it to Home Office for approval and we'll do due diligence.
Right.
So these firms that have 1,000 advisors, let's say they have 150 advisors and they have three people that do alts and they get 25 to 30 requests a year. It's not enough people. It takes forever. Most of these firms have backlogs that go a year plus. So they need help. And the consultants can help, but the consulting world is built for the institutions. They don't do due diligence under the lens of the advisor.
Maybe we can come full circle and start to wrap up with a final question from my perspective anyway. And I'm just wondering, what's one piece of advice you would give allocators and advisors who are starting to explore alternatives or hesitant because of the complexities and the perceived risks, more on the philosophical side? Mm-hmm. Someone's an allocator advisor starting to explore alternatives, starting to think through what kind of alternatives are they diversifying? Are they return enhancing? Yeah. And the complexity and the perceived challenges around measuring risk. What's the advice that you would give them?
My advice is work with experts. Advisors need to realize that there's an opportunity to really stand out from your peers, to really stand out from the crowd here and educate yourself. I always say, be a little intellectually curious. This stuff is fascinating. I have two interns right now. One of them is a 17-year-old named Jacqueline. She's actually a junior sensei at my son's dojo. And last spring, she walked up to me and she said, I want to learn about finance. Can I shadow you? I said, well, why don't you just intern for me this summer? And internship's probably a stretch for what she does for me. But basically, I pay her a very small amount of money to read research reports for me and to listen to podcasts for me and then report back on what she's learning. And then I answer her questions and it's a nice little way for her to learn. And I took her in July to a luncheon with Avenue Capital talking about their sports rights fund with the PM, Mark, who is the former owner of the Milwaukee Bucks. And it was like 20 people and we sat right next to Mark and we talked to him. And she told me yesterday, I saw her yesterday, my son had karate. She was teaching the class and she said, I feel like I need to tell you something. I said, what's that? And she goes, you have gotten me so excited and shown me something that I thought was so boring, but it's not. It's so interesting that I have decided that I'm going to major in finance when I go to college next year. And that's what I mean by intellectual curiosity. Rather than look at it and feel it's daunting and complicated and complex, look at it as an exciting opportunity to learn about what actually does drive capital markets more than what traded on public markets. As you pointed out at the very beginning, 80% of what goes on in capital markets is not what 80% of investors invest in. It's everything behind the scenes. Yep. So it's vast and interesting. And then at times is the reason for things like crazy market movements. The AMC GameStop Robinhood debacle, when we start talking about the plumbing behind things and how regulatory requirements and all that kind of, that's all alt markets. And we talked about shorting. Everybody hates shorts, right? Short managers are considered the devil. They are one of the most important parts of price discovery in the markets. They are excellent at uncovering fraud. Super Micro. There was a short manager that put out a report saying that they did not have appropriate safeguards in place for their financials. Say what you like, but Super Micro announced this morning that they are delaying their 10K filing because of concerns about the integrity of the information, which is exactly what the short manager said was the problem. They didn't admit that's why, but I think it's highly telling that a short manager points this out and all of a sudden the company is not reporting on time. They're remarkably important. They're also remarkably good backdrops when the market's going down. So when you hear regulators say, we're going to ban shorting of financial stocks like they did during the financial crisis, you know what happened? There was no floor because short managers can't go to zero. They have to cover at some point. So they have to buy. And so they provide floors. And again, intellectual curiosity, all this stuff falls into this alt space. So show a little intellectual curiosity. I promise you, it's super interesting and fascinating if you just open your mind and think about it in that respect and not think about it in the, oh my God, it's so complex. I don't get it. But it's so vast. It's so interesting. And ultimately, I think we as advisors and advisors out there win by considering how they can incorporate these things into business developments and their client relationships, because a client that feels like them is not leaving you.
Fabulous.
That was fabulous. I worry that a lot of advisors fall into the latter category. I hope I'm wrong.
I think some of the old school ones do, but I think there's a whole generation coming up that feel differently, and I'm excited about it.
Excellent. Jenna, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insights today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.